Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 12, 2019. Let the record reflect the time is 3:36 p.m. Today we have present Senator Machicki, Senator Reinbold, Senator Kawasaki, Vice Chair Senator Cockey, and myself, Chair Schauer. I'd like to remind everybody and those in the audience, please silence or turn off your cell phones. Staff assisting us today is Carrie up front with records and Taylor behind us with the Leo. We have two items on today's agenda, and that's going to bring up SB 23 and 24, Appropriation Supplemental Payments of Prior Year's PFD, and PFD Supplemental Payments from Rules by Request of the Governor. And then we will bring back up SB 33, Arrest, Release, Sentencing, and Probation for discussion later on. This time we're going to bring up Senate Bill 23, Appropriation Supplemental Payments of Prior Year's PFD from Rules by Request of the Governor. We last heard this bill on Thursday the 7th. We have since opened and closed public testimony. We're going to continue to take written testimony until 6 p.m. Tonight after we move the bills out, assuming that happens. All right. We have some amendments to consider, and I'm going to ask my Vice Chair, Senator Coghill, to make the motion. Senator Coghill, would you please move amendment number one?
As soon as I get there, Mr. Chairman.
No worries.
So, Mr. Chairman, for Senate Bill 23, I move amendment number one, which is A.7, dated 3/9/19.
Is there an objection?
Object.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and speak to the First Amendment. I'm going to ask the Department of Revenue to come forward. We can get Jake. Can you get an extra packet? Stand by 1 second. Take it out. Back on the record. All right, the First Amendment is one put in by request to the Department of Revenue, so I'm going to have Commissioner Bruce Tangeman come up to us, or he's already here at the table, excuse me, after that at ease, lost my point, and go ahead and speak to the amendment. Put yourself on the record, sir.
For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Department of Revenue. This is merely a technical correction due to a miscalculation on the amount for the 2018 portion of the dividend. It goes from 1328 to
$1,388.
$50. Seems pretty simple as far as amendments go.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions on this amendment? Go ahead. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. I guess this is for Commissioner. The amounts are static that we're putting in here, but then the number of applications we may not know, right? So, like, we put placeholders in the budget, for instance, for how much the PFD is, but we don't exactly know how many applicants there will be and how many people will be certified in the end. So this number will move around based on what factors.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the dollar amount will not change. It's the number of applicants that may change. So and that will change because we're assuming you can assume that everybody that received a dividend in 18 would also receive one in 2021. But that's a worst case scenario because the way the bill is presented, you must qualify in 2021 in order to receive the 2018. And obviously people will have moved away, died, etc. So we present our best estimate of the number of folks that will apply, but the number will meet, dollar amount will remain the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll remove my objection.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. All right, is there further discussion to amendment number one? Senator Ramble.
Thank you. Just a point of clarification. I mean, how did this get miscalculated in the first place?
It was simply a simple miscalculation in the spreadsheet. Nothing more, nothing less.
Follow up. And
what's
the total additional unstructured draw? With $50,
the additional amount that would be repaid is between $4 and $5 million, depending on the number of folks that will actually end up receiving the dividend.
Would you like to follow up, Ken? Yeah. Okay. Further discussion on amendment number one.
I've already withdrawn my amendment or my
making
objection.
Sure. Okay. All right. Yes, sir. At ease. Back on the record. Commissioner Tangeman, I believe you wanted to speak to this again.
Yes, sir, if I could clarify that number. We estimate about 530,000 people would qualify, times $60, which is the delta between the two. That is more in the $40 million range.
Okay, thank you.
Not $4 to $5 million.
Yeah, minus a zero.
Yes,
sir. Or two. Copy. All right, after that correction, I will go back on the record here. Does anybody else wish to ask more questions with that correction? Okay. All right, Senator Coghill.
So without objection, that passes.
Right? I thought you were going to have another point to make. So seeing none, amendment number one has been adopted, and we have amendment in the packet number two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move amendment number two.
I'll object. Oh.
Go ahead.
All right.
Okay, can Senator Kawasaki, can you speak to your objection or to the amendment, please?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I provided a memo last week. It's an eight-page memo from our legislative legal services, just discussing the legality and constitutionality of this bill. I think that there are still infirmities within this bill that make it unconstitutional. In the packet, I know that we also did receive a six-page memo from the Department of Law Civil Division to discuss why they believe it is constitutional. I haven't wrapped my head around the memo, but there are two ways in which the suspected infirmity could be cured according to the department or the legislative legal services. One way is to say that if you did qualify for a 2016 PFD, regardless of whether you qualify for a 2018 PFD, 19 PFD, thank you, that you would get your PFD. The other way to do that, and you'd have to do it in both pieces of legislation, the other way to do that would be to that, let's see, the other way to do that would be the supplemental payment could be made to all 2019, 2020, and 2021 recipients, regardless of the residency in those 3 years. This is the cure that they found in legislative legal to, they believe, will make this a constitutional piece of legislation. Absent that, again, we've got dueling memos about whether it's constitutional or not. I don't think that it'll stand constitutional muster. I'm worried that if this bill were to become law, all it would take is one person to object to the rationale in this bill, which could jeopardize those future PFD payouts. I'm still deeply concerned with that, and that's why I've introduced these amendments. But I will read this memo, and I'll just I guess I'd like to hear from the commissioner if he has an opportunity to.
Okay, we also have the Department of Law is here with that memo as well. So we may want to go ahead, Mr. Tangeman, if you'd like to go ahead and comment first.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and for the question, Senator Kawasaki. Our Department of Law does believe it is constitutional. As you said, we have dueling memos. If you'd like me to speak to this amendment, I could go ahead and do that as well. So the intent of this amendment starts to stray from the intent of what the governor introduced. It greatly overcomplicates the simplistic way that we've implemented or introduced the bill. Some of the bigger concerns are the fact that there's a healthy number of people who did receive a dividend in 2016 who no longer live in Alaska, who may be dead, There's just a lot of things that we will have to turn part of our department into a search and rescue type operation, because are we going to then have to track these people down to every corner of the globe in order for them to get their dividend? So it starts to complicate things that way. You know, when you apply, and I pulled up my application sheet, when you sign it, it says, first thing, I certify that on the date of application, I am now and intend to remain in Alaska resident indefinitely. Now, it's intent language, obviously, but the reason that we're using this approach where we, if you received a 2016 dividend and qualify for an FY19 dividend, you get that back pay, it's because you're still here in Alaska. So it makes it a lot more less complicated, more streamlined, easier to implement. Just the cost of, as we were talking earlier, you know, not everybody that received a dividend in 2016 is still here and will receive a 2019 dividend. So this will probably add, we estimate that over a three-year span, we lose about 100,000 people that had received a dividend. So over those 3 years, people have left, died, et cetera. So just the sheer cost is about $150, $160 million in additional costs to get these back payments to every single 2016 recipient. So the cost is much more, and just the implementation of it in order to track these people down would make it very, very onerous on the department.
Senator Kawasaki, go ahead.
Thank you. Just I guess if this amendment were to pass, wouldn't the department just essentially implement, take the 2016 dividends, figure out where the person lived, or and then issue that additional payment? Or would it? I guess I'm trying to figure out how the process works for the repayment plan.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, in the simplest of forms, yes. But we're talking about 600 plus thousand applicants who have changed bank accounts, who have moved out of state, who have died. Are we dealing with estates now of people who are deceased? For that tremendous amount of Alaskans, the complexity just goes up many, many fold. So it's not as simple as pulling up the 2016 register and hitting print again and sending out $1,000 plus. We're going to be tracking down tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. I don't know how many here, maybe you've changed your own bank account, which account that your dividends are deposited into. That's going to affect a lot of people. So just the undertaking from the department's perspective of how we would actually implement this is fairly staggering.
I appreciate the point. There's two words that start with a C. One is complicated. One is constitutional. One we can argue about. The other one we don't have much of a choice
right.
on. So, and this brings up a good point, which is why it might be worth having the Department of Law come up and also speak to the opinion, because it is the court of law and they get into opinions. So one argue, you know, one side, one the other. Mm-hmm. But complicated will not answer the question necessarily. We have to make sure we're answering the tougher one constitutionally, and I appreciate the answer. Mm-hmm. So we do, I think, need to resolve this in the committee members' minds before we would pass or not this amendment, just to make sure. So probably the appropriate person is sitting there beside you. If you wouldn't mind, sir, please put yourself on the record, and could you talk to us about this?
Sure, Mr. Chair. It's Assistant Attorney General Bill Milks from Department of Law. Pursuant to the committee's request, we submitted in writing our position on this bill, on the legalities of the bill, how we see it. And we think this bill would be determined to be constitutional. We think there's a couple critical facts that lead us to that conclusion. That doesn't mean I have certainly reviewed the legislative legal opinion and respect that opinion and understand where its analysis is coming from, mostly dealing with general case law that deals with general residency requirements. I guess in our view, we think that the legislature does have the means to accomplish the limited objective of this bill, which is to provide for Alaska residents payment regarding if they had qualified and were paid PFDs, they did not receive the full amount from the statutory formula. We think the legislature does have the means to narrowly focus on that group. And our view on it is basically turns on the permanent fund dividend program is unique. It's the only one that exists in the United States, really. And so it's really different from other kinds of state benefit programs that states have enacted that make some distinctions between residents. And this law is also unique because it's a temporary law. It's not a long-term change in the permanent fund dividend program. And it's addressed at very specific facts, the ones that the commissioner has described and what's provided in the support for the bill and the governor's transmittal. So it's after very specific facts, dealing with a unique law. And in our mind, we think a court that would review it would uphold this narrow focus legislation, and that's basically because there's two ways to analyze these kinds of legislative enactments. There's rational basis review, which is the most standard and common review of any legislature's enactments. And there, the courts are very clear. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that when you're applying rational basis review, you look at whether or not the legislature had any reasonably conceivable state of facts that could provide a rational basis for the classification. So to us, the classification here, particularly on this amendment, is between two groups of Alaska residents, those who experienced, who qualified for a PFD in the past but did not receive the statutory payment, and those who didn't qualify for that past payment. So we think that the legislature, that is a, there's a rational basis to address that set of facts. And we think the, additionally, the Alaska Supreme Court's talked about a concern with the PFD, which is important to courts, which is individuals taking advantage of a state's benefit program by what they call a portable benefit, moving in for a short period of time, taking the benefit and leaving. And so the Alaska Supreme Court's talked about that's a real concern with the PFD also, which leads them to more of this rational basis review when the legislature tries to put safeguards on it. So our memo more fully sets out how we view this, but that is in sum and substance. We think the legislature does have the ability to address the issue.
I know Senator Kawasaki, I think, had a follow-up if you wanted to direct that.
Thank you. As you were discussing the differences between the two classes, it doesn't take into account residency in 2019, 2020, 2021, 2022. A person could have been absolutely received their PFD, which wasn't completely paid out. And so we are trying to, and the governor has said that he believes that that is an entitlement that they should receive. But the person could now not be qualified to apply for the PFD on the current on the PFD form, and then just, even though that they were there for that year. So I guess I only got to read it, just got it a couple hours ago. It doesn't seem to address the residency issue about a person who is a resident now versus a resident, versus a person who had been entitled to the PFD but just not gotten it.
Through the chair, what we're addressing is this bill that's providing for two residency requirements. So when the PFD was not paid pursuant to the statutory formula in 2016, an Alaska resident this year who also experienced the underpayment would be eligible to receive the PFD. And we think that that's a rational approach by the legislature could take. If we're going to provide a supplemental payment or additional payment this year, we're going to say the people qualified are those who are Alaska residents right now and people who experience the underpayment. So that's our analysis, but that's how we make that distinction between the. So we don't see this as a kind of bill, that legislation that has been challenged in other cases where you put in what a court might think is an excessive residency requirement to receive, for example, welfare benefits, which is what a common scenario that's been reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court and others is a state, in order to deter people from moving in, will set up a fairly burdensome residency requirement to receive that payment. But this is not that situation at all. This is addressing a very unique fact. It's not setting in concrete any long-term change in the residency requirements for the PFD program.
So, follow up.
Do you believe that this could be challenged by an Alaska resident who received a 2016 PFD, but not the entire amount, but currently would not qualify for this piece of legislation?
Through the chair, certainly I believe, and we have lawsuits all the time. It keeps department law going. Yes, I believe an individual could bring a legal challenge. Our view is that the legal challenge would be unsuccessful, but I don't think the legislature and all your legislations always drawing lines between individuals or groups on programs, and they're always susceptible to some kind of legal challenge. We try to assess whether or not we think it's how strong the legal challenge is. And I think for the reasons we put in the letter and I've explained, we think that the legislation could withstand a legal challenge. But I certainly acknowledge you have another opinion which tilts the other way from your legislative legal services.
Let me ask you a question real quick before we get to a follow-up, and Senator Coghill's got a question as well. If the legal challenge was filed, if that was to happen, how would that hold up, or would it hold up this moving forward as far as this bill itself? Would it put it in limbo as it went through this year, or would this program continue if it, say, was passed and then challenged? What would that do?
Through the chair, the PFD program would just continue.
The payback specifically,
the
this
payback
portion
specifically,
I'm talking about.
If there was a legal challenge, there wouldn't be. A legal challenge wouldn't be what we call ripe until there was actually this bill or some similar bill was enacted into law. And then I would imagine the legal challenge would be an effort to get an injunction against the additional payment.
So we could be held up for some time if it was to happen. This is more for the record for people. If this passed and it was challenged, it would put everything in limbo. That's my words for some
through
amount of
the
time.
Chair, the judicial branch can review all laws passed by the legislature.
Understood. Okay. I'll go to Senator Coghill next.
Well, maybe you can help me understand the difference between some of the opinions we have and how the courts generally will process those. So we're talking about equal protection and residency requirements. Yours talking about a rational test, rational based test, is that right?
Yes.
So the court's going to see that, and they're going to take a look at several criteria probably to decide if they'll even accept it on one of these bases. I know there's some criteria, but I don't remember it all. Can you help me or help us understand how they have been able to go through those? I think, for example, on if people are similarly situated or there's other requirements that they'll have.
Yes, through the chair. Yes, Senator Coghill. So I've used that shorthand term, rational basis. That's a term from U.S. Supreme Court case law for a very, very long time. It's the default or typical way that the courts will review legislation because they understand all legislation is drawing lines somewhere. Some people get a benefit, some don't. Some get there's some burden on folks, others don't have it. So In general, the courts do not want to be involved in having to second-guess the elected branches of government. And that's where the quote I had before came from the U.S. Supreme Court about any set of facts that could rationally support the distinction be made. That's typically the standard. Which is very deferential to the elected branch. So the courts are not typically in the business of saying what the elected branches of government did is unconstitutional. But there are cases that they can. And then I think if you're talking about those standards of review, then the next one would be the highest one is the strict scrutiny standard. So if you passed a bill that made a distinction between residents based on, for example, age or race or sex, that's going to be at strict scrutiny. And so then you'd have to have some compelling governmental reasons for a court to accept a distinction on those suspect criteria. When the courts have been grappling with these residency requirements, these durational requirements, they're doing what we call an equal protection analysis, which is this usually rational basis, but it could go to suspect classification. And I'm sorry to have to get Senator, you asked the question, so it's a little hard to not go too deep into it. But normally the strict scrutiny is on those basic distinctions, race, sex, gender you can't make. It's also been raised about the right to travel. That the right to travel is an important constitutional right. So if you restrict the right to travel, maybe a court would apply a strict scrutiny test, or maybe they'd apply a rational basis test. The Alaska Supreme Court a few years ago talked about when you should, how you should treat these right to travel cases in the context of the PFD. And in that context, the court upheld residency requirements for the permanent fund dividend, and it was contrasting the cases that put a very high standard on strict scrutiny, which is usually some kind of ongoing governmental benefit. And they said even the Supreme Court's recognized that when you're dealing with a state providing what they call a highly portable benefit, that the legislature's given much more leeway, much closer to the rational basis review. Because, and they specifically talked about the problems with permanent fund dividends. Someone could move up and decide, oh, I know if I move up to Alaska, if they have really easy residency requirements, I can get an annual dividend. So from those group of cases trying to sort out, basically, I think, Senator Coghlan, you hit it, whether or not we think a court would look at whether or not there's a rational basis for the legislation and be focused on the unique facts, the PFD program. And the Supreme Court, in the one case we have about the PFD program, the Zobel case, the U.S. Supreme Court applied rational basis standard review, not strict scrutiny, to the PFD. So ultimately that's how trying to sort out what the precedents are from the United States Supreme Court and Alaska Supreme Court. And we looked at this bill as a unique bill dealing with a unique program, and we don't think the courts will conclude that the legislative branch has no ability to address, because it's all about addressing a unique set of facts. And the options here are, you can either, can you address these unique set of facts, or do you have to change the program somehow to permit the additional payments to go to individuals who did not actually suffer the reduction? Or do you have to open up to people who aren't residents anymore? We think you're dealing with a unique set of facts, and a court would recognize that.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to have that because we were brought to see two different standards, and I was trying to figure out how the court would see them in a ladder of decision making. At one would be the highest, and one would be the lowest level of scrutiny. And so as we go through this, it's helpful for us to see how they would see it, only because with a unique set of facts, as has said, we're also wandering into an area of complication. And as we wander into that area of complication, the further we look into it, the harder I think that test gets. And so I think that's something I just wanted to hear from the department, especially from the law department, how they would see somebody lay it out in front of them saying, here are the tests that we're going to have at the front door as we look at this. So that's why I brought that up.
To be honest with you, I don't mind the deep discussion on this one because it's fascinating to me. I'm not a lawyer. And, Mr. Tangema, I'm very disappointed you couldn't go to that depth in answering that question.
I could have tried.
You could do better. So thank you. So I don't want to make light of it, but I actually am fascinated by the discussion to dig down deep and why, because clearly it's a risk. We always take a risk, as you said. There's always lawsuits that you're fighting off from one thing or another, so there's no doubt that anybody could challenge, and well, there was a challenge to the cap of the PFE, which I believe was lost with the Supreme Court. So that's just one more issue that this comes up. Senator Machicki had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I approach this from sort of the practical side and the legal side. On the practical side, I oppose Amendment Number 2. I think we have enough leakage of the PFD outside of the state. The permanent fund dividend was designed for Alaska residents, and Amendment Number 2 just provides payment for people that do not any longer, they're no longer committed to the state of Alaska. And the original Alaska Inc. that was challenged by the Zobels required commitment and longevity for highest payments. The longevity piece was what was the problem. So we no longer have that. But the commissioner pointed out the question that people do check off, that they intend to remain in Alaska. So when I get to the legal part, I think the Harris versus Hahn is a good consideration, and I think it's a fair comparison on the rational basis. And that was when resident veterans attending public universities, if they had enlisted in Texas or was a resident of Texas at the time, and it was the rational basis where it was found to be constitutional was for its residency at enlistment requirement, which in this case is residency at time of payment, which I think is a very fair comparison. So with the three-year slide following 16, 17, and 18, the same gap, I can't think of a more rational basis for the consideration of the administration, and I support their approach. Again, we have enough leakage of the PFD out of state. I'm not going to question at what percentage some of those folks are no longer residents, but I'm certainly not going to support additional leakage out of the state. So I can't support Amendment Number 2, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Chick. Just to make sure, Senator Reinbold, I couldn't tell if you had your hand up. Did I miss you? Yes, ma'am. Senator Kawasaki, I believe you want to continue with the
Q&A. Yeah, thank you. And it goes along the same questions the chairman had. If somebody were to try to enjoin the payments of the PFDs pending an outcome of a trial, what's the next step? What happens if you lose, if the state of Alaska loses and it's deemed an unconstitutional law? What then happens to the permanent fund payout?
Through the chair, I imagine if we had a first, they would file a challenge, and it would be at the trial court level. And if the state lost that challenge, then we review with the Attorney General and determine whether or not to file an appeal.
And then, through the chair, and then what happens after that? You file an appeal, it goes to the Supreme Court, or if you decide to file an appeal, it goes to the Supreme Court, what happens to the PFD payout?
Well, through the chair, I think that would depend on what the trial court did. If the trial court decided we are going to issue an injunction blocking the payout, then it would be blocked until we got to the Supreme Court and persuaded them to that the legislation is constitutional. If the Superior Court decided not to do that and permitted the payout to go according to the residency requirements and let the appeal and but ruled in favor of the non-residents, and that goes up on appeal, then that issue gets dealt with. But it's basically once you have a lawsuit, sure, it's in the judicial branch, and so we will make every argument that we could make if this law bill became law to say it's constitutional.
So through the chair, I guess my question is, once all those routes are exhausted and basically they believe Ledge Legal's memo more than they believe yours, and they deem it, the entire law, unconstitutional, what happens to the PFD payout?
Well, through the chair, if the court ruled that the PFD payout, as it's provided here, is unconstitutional, then it wouldn't be paid, and the legislature would have to consider whether or not, and it would mean it's unconstitutional, so it wouldn't happen.
And then I guess this is for Commissioner. I guess why wouldn't we try to approach this differently, like have people reapply, for instance, and have everybody just be on the same level, reapply for the 2016 added payment? Wouldn't that all, I suspect that that would cure the infirmity that I see in this particular law.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the reason is within our application system, we already have the entire list of people that received the 2016 dividend. If they're applying through the 2019 dividend, then we're just marrying up those two lists. So it's a technical exercise at that point. Instead of requiring people to reapply for something that happened 3 years ago, we can just pull those applicants that actually received a dividend, compare it to the 2019 applications who are qualified, and those are the people that receive it.
Through the chair.
I'm going to give you the indulgence because I know you asked a question on that too, and I don't mind digging on this one because this is an important discussion, so please continue.
I didn't get a chance to fully read the Mr. Milks. I appreciated it coming in. I just haven't had a chance to totally review it, so I will have an opportunity later on, and I don't intend to push the other amendments at this time, but I do have a concern, and my concern is that if the PFD is a benefit that was owed to Alaskans, as was stated in public and in this in our cover letter, then I believe that it should be paid to those people. And I know that there's lots of reasons why people on the forum have left. We've had a down market economy. Person could be trade union working down in Seattle because they can't find a job right here in Juneau, and then suddenly be denied the ability to have that PFD, even though I think the governor believes, and some of us believe too, that person should have had the full PFD the entire time. That's what I'm trying to get to when I try to find a way to cure what I think is a problem. So that's why I've introduced these amendments. But I will take a chance to look at this a little bit more before. And then at this time, I'm just going to withdraw amendment number 2 and amendment number 3.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Gentlemen, if you can probably exit the table, I think, at this point. We'll see how it goes. I get back on my paperwork after that discussion. All right. And I forgot after that who made the objection. Thank you. Senator Machicki, would you like to maintain your objection now that it's been pulled?
No.
Okay. And we have amendments. Make sure I've got them, 2, 3, and 4. They're going to be all recalled. All right. Then that is all the amendments in that case, so we are done there. That was the last amendment with an S at the end. The bill, as amended now, is before the committee for discussion. Is there further discussion for Senate Bill 23 at this time? It is my intent to go ahead and move this bill today. Can I get a motion to do so?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate State Affairs Committee move the Senate Bill number 23 as amended. That would be the 8 version as amended. With individual recommendations and the fiscal notes to go with it, and any technical changes that the drafters need to make to conform that amendment.
Okay. And do you mind reading that version? I think we have to read that for the record, Greg.
The 31-GS1014/A is amended.
Thank you. Do we have any objections to moving the bill? All right. By with no objections, the bill is accepted and moved. We're going to continue on to Senate Bill number 24.
You want to, Mr. Chairman, do you want to do the signing of all the bills after that?
I think we're going to do it after was the plan. All so right. We'll continue. So we're going to go ahead and bring up Senate Bill 24 this time. Stand by a moment. Take it out of the way. One. All right, bringing up Senate Bill 24, PFD Supplemental Payments from Rules by Request of the Governor. We last heard this bill on Thursday, the 7th of March. We have since opened and closed public testimony, and we'll take written testimony still until 6 p.m. tonight, assuming that we move this bill out as well. All right, and here we go on the next one. We have Senate Bill 24 to consider before us, and we have an amendment, one amendment now at this time for Senate Bill number 24. Senator Cargill, could you make a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one for Senate Bill 24, which is the A.6 amendment for number one.
I'll object for discussion.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. And we're going to go ahead and at this time to expedite the discussion, if everyone is so inclined, that this is the exact same amendment for the 1328 to 88, so nothing is different. This is simply just making that technical change for Senate Bill 24. So does anyone have questions on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Objection? I would like to remove my objection to amendment
okay.
number one.
Is there further discussion on amendment number one for Senate Bill 24? Okay. Seeing none, amendment number one has been adopted, and we will go back to the last amendment for Senate Bill number 24. Is there further discussion on Senate Bill 24 this time? My intent is to move this bill as well. Senator Cockhill, could I get a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill number 24 as amended, version 31-GS1013/A, with individual recommendations, the task force notes, and any revisions that the Secretary needs to make to make that amendment technically correct.
Thank you, Senator Cockhill. Are there any objections? All right. We're going to go ahead and move this bill from the committee as well. At this time, we're going to take an at ease and sign the paperwork, and we'll get ready to go to Senate Bill 33. All right, State Affairs back on the record. We're going to bring up Senate Bill 33, Arrest, Release, Sentencing, Probation. With the Department of Law, please come to the table. Back in the hot seat. And we also should have a few others that are here available in the room as we need them. So see the courts here, and we've got DOC. So as the lifelines are required, we will have them available for you. Can you please state your name and title for the record, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division.
Thank you very much. I'm just putting you in the hot seat here for a minute as we get started, because there will be questions. I have some myself. My intent for today, open this back up for discussions, concerns, questions, anybody, any of the committee members have over Senate Bill 33. Switching back into the crime mode, I'm going to let members at this time open up with questions. I am specifically bringing the Department of Law, but the other departments are here as required. We will play the round robin as needed, and that is the intent today, is to now dig us back into 33 to try to get this one moving and figure out where we sit at the 30,000-foot view. And just as a reminder for the committee, this bill does go to Judiciary next, so they will take a hard look at that in that committee. So just for everybody's information. All right, and at this time, I'm going to go ahead and open it up, and we're going to get started with questions. Anybody else has one they want to start, or else I will. Okay, then. Here we go. Speaking of, as you did, you hesitated. So starting off in, I'll get make sure I'm in the right section here. Section 2. We have a number of things that we're looking at where we have APSC certified police officers, and let me get to that. Make sure, let me catch up with you. Pull my bill out. Got my questions in front of me, but not the bill. I apologize. I have a question on Section 2, Line 8, when you're ready, if you want to. Okay, and the requirement applies to municipal police officers to the same extent as it does to state troopers. So curious as why we made that change, because we deleted a lot before that. So I think the intent or the question is, why are we changing? Why was it changed between them?
So, Mr. Chairman, let me try to answer that question. When you look at that section, Section 2, that's an amendment to 1225, which is not an amendment to 1230. So the bail provisions of this bill, the pretrial release provisions, that's in Title 12, Chapter 30, 1230. 1225 is actually the arrest provision. So that's what dictates law enforcement. So it is a peace officer's authority. And in fact, it's actually titled The Rights of a Prisoner After Arrest. So your question as to whether or not, I want to make sure I understand your question, is your question whether or not it needs to be expanded to peace officers generally?
Yes, and then there's a generic, while you're answering that, I'm going to go skip ahead of definitions. Peace officer versus police officer are different, and it is used throughout in multiple places here, so I want to make sure we're clearing that up as well.
Sure.
That definition.
Mr. Chairman, that your second question is a much more complicated question, and it's,
I acknowledge that.
And it's in part because peace officer is defined in various, in at least two places in the law. So, but with respect to your first question, limiting the arrest provision to troopers and to municipal police officers, it would make sense that if you include, to make it more clear, if you include VPSOs and VPOs as identified or certified under Title 18. But I will tell you, in practice, I don't want to speak for DPS, but in practice, when those arrests are made by VPSOs and VPOs, the troopers are generally involved in that arrest, and they're going to be the entity, the public entity, that's going to be responsible for getting that person to court within 24 hours. And in our communities in which the troopers do not service, those are going to be serviced by the municipal police officers.
Sorry, trying to catch up. I'm going to keep my iPad up to speed as well. So, Sarah Machicki, go ahead, please.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Henderson, right?
Yes.
I should know that. What? So that would be the same, you're assuming the same for a park ranger or a citizen's arrest. At some point, the official arrest is made by either a trooper or a municipal police officer. Is that correct? Is there some sort of required handoff?
So, through the chair, Senator, your question is very interesting, because when I look at the rest of Title 1225, the arrest, we speak to peace officer, and in fact, in Title 1225-02-050 is the only place that I see that we limit it to just municipal police officers. If you were to change that to peace officers, so in the event that any public servant who is authorized to make that arrest, that they would be obligated to bring that person to the magistrate within 24 hours. There may be, you know, we have to think about this practically as well. You know, once somebody's in the care and custody of either a municipal police officer or a trooper, those entities have the means and mechanisms to ensure that person appears before that judicial officer. So by broadening that definition to peace officers, we do that to those entities, those certified peace officers like VP, village police officers or village public safety officers, that are certified but may not have the means or mechanism in which to make sure that that person is transported and appears before that judicial officer within that 24 hours or 48 hours as amended.
So follow up. Yeah, no, I because I was looking at this as well. What if a VPSO is unable just due to weather, or a park ranger or some other person with authority is unable to, you know, get weathered in on the west side of the inlet or somewhere in northwest Alaska, and they simply does that. How would this impact the arrest or the arraignment? I mean, should we add the words whenever possible or something like that so that it would not make the arrest no longer legal?
Through the chair, Senator, I do not believe we have a representative from the Department of Public Safety, but that those practical concerns are concerns that I would like to discuss with public safety as to how they would manage that, and how would they manage that type of scenario.
I'm going to add to that, and then I'm going to go to Senator Coghill, just because it follows up, dovetails nicely with Senator Machicki's question. And part of this gets to the definition as far as how narrow it is, because I think as we're looking at the VPSO program, I don't think we're thinking along those lines. So we're not giving them the same powers, and that's we're talking about a little bit more broadly than this, but that's kind of where the question comes from. And Senator Machicki's kind of taking that down a different vein, so there's kind of two parts to that. Senator Coghill had a question on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, 1225-150 has a couple of different parts to it, and we only have A here. However, the change is to 48 hours. And I think the whole discussion, I remember some of the discussion on the 48 versus 24 hours. A lot of it is, how do you get people who have been arrested their right to make their case before a magistrate as soon as practical? And so interject the pretrial officers, and you'll see the deleted language had a pretrial officer had to make a report. So we were saying we wanted that within 24 hours with that report, no later than 48 hours. They're just taking that portion out and saying 48 hours, but it has to be with no unnecessary delay. And I think the idea is, and this is for the troopers and the municipal police, they need to get somebody in front of a judge to say why they arrested them as soon as they possibly can. And so the unnecessary delay is a big part, as well as a 48 hour. So I think our discussion, and I'm curious why we wouldn't start with the first 24 hours. Of course, I want to include the pretrial services without their delay. And then have no later than 48 hours still as the backdrop. So maybe that's the policy call I'd like to have the administration share with me, why the 48 hours first instead of last. You know, because we started with 24 hours and under circumstances 48. But you've taken the circumstances out and said no, the 48 period.
Yeah. So through the chair, so all of when we're talking about the 48 hours and we talk about it collectively, we're talking about the constitutional obligation for to ensure that an arrestee is brought before a judicial officer within a reasonable time. And states are entitled to define what that reasonable time is within some boundaries under U.S. Supreme Court case law. But the reason we have identified 48 hours is absent compelling circumstances is because we're setting the maximum. What we're saying is that, and I fully anticipate and I believe that law enforcement will continue to take reasonable efforts to ensure that somebody appears in front of a judge as soon as possible. But we want to make sure that they don't, if they're unable to, they're not also forced with, if it's over 24 hours, if it's 25 hours, now they have to go before the judge, and now they also have to articulate, why are they 1 hour too late? Why are they 2 hours too late? As opposed to just setting a bar at 48 hours and allowing the officer to meet that general time frame. This is, again, what we're doing is we're talking about ensuring that there's discretion and ensuring that person makes it before the court at a reasonable time.
I'll put this on the record as well. We researched this because one of the questions of 24 versus 48 and precedent. The court rule has been researched. There is a case law, SCOTUS County of Riverside versus McLaughlin, or McLeod, I think we got it wrong. Said 48 hours is okay, so just wanted to know that we had the legislative intent on that, just so that that question has been asked. And there is a footnote on the court rules about the 24-hour rule intention with 48 in case law, and that's on Rule 5, page 15 for the last note, just so FYI for the committee and the record. Senator Reinbold.
And this is important discussion. I have so many questions. I don't know where to start. That's why I was asking, you know, to possibly meet you in the office because I don't want to dominate the discussion today. But this is one of my many questions. I actually have called around and talked to a lot of people, and they basically think 72 hours is a much better idea than 48 because of courts not being open over the weekend or court staff not being there. It could tremendously help reduce the fiscal impacts of just having that. If they can, they get there as quick as they can, but it will dramatically reduce the cost if we don't have to have every court or everything open, you know, so many different hours. But anyway, just want to get that on record. I do have an amendment drafted for 72 hours.
Okay. Next questions? Yeah. Senator Machegi?
I didn't get it particularly clear. I mean, before it was 24 hours, and even the pretrial service report, it was clear the delay in the transmittal of that report may not be considered a sufficient compelling circumstance to justify delaying a hearing beyond 24 hours. I mean, they drew a pretty tight 24-hour sort of no-excuse thing. Is this an issue on the 48 that are we exaggerating the concern? Is 48 hours, is there a problem that people are going to run over 48 where that's a problem on actually getting their initial hearing to occur?
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that question.
Please do.
Has there been a problem getting them there in the 24 hours?
So through the chair, senators, I am unaware of a particular case. I can't think of a case right now in which we've had this issue where we would have some type of dismissal as a result of not meeting that 24-hour. But that's in part because once that rule is set, that became the norm. That's what everybody had to meet, and that's what we did. What we're trying to do is return us to where we were pre-2016 to provide that flexibility.
Senator Rabel.
I don't know if it's appropriate or not, but at some point in time, Nancy Mead, if she could come up and speak to that whenever is appropriate. Maybe it's not this time, but I don't know how difficult it is to meet, you know, the 70, you know, the 48, 24, 48, 72 hour.
Do you have information that would be helpful? You're welcome to stay.
Oh.
Like I said, this is going to be a round robin, I think, as we continue through the last few of these, so you might as well just park it.
I'll try. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. This statute has gone back and forth between 48 and 24. It used to be 48, and then it was 24. The court system provides hearings within 24 hours. Nearly every single solitary defendant, even when it was 48, was arraigned within 24 hours. There is an on-call judicial officer available every weekend, all the time, and So the only time people were not arraigned within 24 hours were situations where, the rare situation where the prosecutor can ask for more time to gather more information for a bail hearing for certain felonies, or the more common reason people wouldn't make it within 24 hours was if they were not in a medical condition to appear in court, for example, being intoxicated. And so then it could go to 48 hours. We have not experienced any problem with 24 or 48. And as I say, even with 48, it would probably be 24 in almost every situation.
So before I go to Senator Reinbold for that follow-up, in the court's opinion, I'll play lawyer for a second. So in your opinion, do you feel that this would be a change that would be helpful or provide that flexibility? Is there the pro and the con of doing so?
To the chair, I try not to offer my opinion on things like that. We haven't had a problem whether it's 24 or 48, though, I will say that.
Well, that's kind of giving me my answer, the flexibility. You don't really feel like it's needed based on the information that you currently have. It's just a difference of opinion between the court. Copy that. Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so a couple different questions, because it depends on who you talk to. They're going to have a totally different opinion. You know, if the witness, you know, haven't had opportunity to be interviewed, if there's, you know, the victim is in the, you know, they weren't able to get all the information because they were beat up so badly. Bottom line, I'm just trying to reduce costs if we can. That's where I'd like to do. And if it's increasing the cost of the courts or the DA's office or anybody by having to be open all the time or on the weekends and things like that, my whole mission here is to have the opportunity to get the best data possible on what's going on and not have to have state employees, you know, on unnecessarily. I know they're on call, but it's still expensive, you know, when they come in. So anyway, that's just my intent here. Just want to get it on the record, have the discussion, you know, whether it goes forth or not, I don't know, but I think it's an important discussion because I definitely hear a different opinion than what you just brought forth.
And through the chair to Senator Reinbold, the one thing I could add is I can't identify any cost that's added by having judges on call on the weekend. They have to be on call. In Anchorage, we have magistrate judges that can cover, and in other locations, sometimes the presiding judge, whoever, is on call all the time, but also for other reasons than just this. They may be on call for emergency DV petitions, emergency China issues, search warrants, things like that. So I can't identify any fiscal impact from the time frame.
Follow up.
Just to follow, and is there's no, so I mean, this is just kind of alarming too, it's surprising, I guess, so there's no increase with DA costs, there's no increase with staffing costs, there's no increase with court, you know, assistants having to come in, nothing like that. It's just kind of free, I mean, because you're already paying for it all.
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, that's correct. The judges don't get any extra money, the in-court, you know, no one gets any extra money to come in on Saturday.
Okay. Good.
At least, I can't speak for the agencies.
Okay.
Go ahead, I think there's a follow-up there before we go, Senator Machicki.
Through the chair, Senator, there is a fiscal impact to the Department of Law. You know, we're a separate branch of government, so we do pay. We have the cost of bringing in the staff and to prepare the information, to prepare the charging documents, and prepare us for trial. The lawyers are the prosecutors are salaried, so their cost is fixed. But for our support staff, that is not a fixed cost.
It would be interesting to see what that data is if somebody has that. I can't imagine who might track that, but. Is there the possibility of getting that back to the committee to know what might change if we extended?
Mr. Chair, I don't want to make any promises, but I may be able to.
Okay, thanks. Any follow-up? Senator Chicken, I think you had a question.
Yeah, so two questions. Should we change the definition of peace officers is the first one in this section.
Through the chair, Senator, before I make a formal opinion on that, I'd like to talk to DPS and see how this would impact them.
Mrs. Mead, sorry.
Don't go away yet.
You almost made it, but you're ID'd. So nice try.
I just thought you moved on. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, second one. I'm willing to wait for that answer. The second one is, should we, this is kind of a must do thing, whether we get a 24 or 48. If you need an extension, is there a process that can occur today if you need to go beyond 24 hours?
Through the chair, Senator, there is. And okay. You'll see that corresponding change actually in Section 3 of the bill, is that safety valve if necessary. The one other, and I don't want to again speak for my colleague at the court system, but the one other aspect to keep in mind is that by moving this to 48 hours, it becomes consistent with court rule, which court rule 5 allows for 48 hours.
Final is, it seems like 48, unless you're arrested between Friday at 5 p.m. and 6 a.m. on Saturday, 48 negates the need for weekend services. Isn't that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Machicki, again, we do have that weekend on-call judicial officer for many purposes, and so they'll get the call Saturday at noon or Sunday at noon. But, I mean, I understand your point. They wouldn't have to, but I think it's standard that people call right away because of the constitutional right of the defendant to be seen quickly.
Mr. Chairman, my question was for the Department of Law, who said that they do have to man up for those weekend calls.
I think we've asked for the data, but feel free to go ahead and answer.
Yeah, so through the chair, Senator Machicki, it would most likely alleviate the need for a one day, so a Saturday, but we probably still have to appear for Sunday because of the timing. Now, recognize that if agreements are still going to occur, the prosecution is going to be there.
And Senator Cogle, I believe, had a question for Mrs. Mead.
I do, but I just want to comment on this section, and then I want to go to section one where we're requiring something by intent. So the 24 hours was on a couple of accounts. One, swift and certain, which we could have a further discussion on that. The other thing, though, is you want to get bad actors, but y'all will also have to deal with an overzealous government. So those are the two bookends of what we have to continue to think about is you may be a good actor with an overzealous government, and you might be a bad actor with a lazy government. I mean, we always have to think of all of those things in context. So just for what it's worth, and we were trying to get somebody in front of a judge so they have to answer, but they also have the right to answer. So those are the things that I remember in that discussion. So The other thing is, while Nancy Mead's here, the intent language is directive, but I just would like to get their idea of what they're doing now and what this intent language might direct them better to do, or if this is important language in the bill, if it's something you're already doing. Intent language is always a tough thing, but there's going to be other areas you'd answer to, but on this one, they're asking you to do something, continued efforts, whenever possible, do things. So have you read this intent language, and and is this already in motion, or is it something new to you?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I actually very much appreciate the question. I have read that section and have been discussing that section along with the corresponding rule changes having to do with video conferencing that are in the latter parts of the bill. And discussed the fact with the Department of Law that perhaps the wording could be modified a little bit. And I think they're open to that and are considering some of the changes I suggested. Part of the issue with the legislative intent is that there is a lot of video conferencing going on right now between the court system and jails. And 100% of that is because the courts made it happen. And 100% of the money saved is really for the Department of Public Safety. And so seeing the intent language that the court do this raised my eyebrows a little bit. We have staff that work on this. And on the other hand, the legislative intent isn't harmful. We will continue to find efficiencies and work on that project. It's safer for people not to have to transport prisoners, for one thing. And it does prevent movement within the courthouses of prisoners to have video conferencing. It's better for DOC. They don't have to search people as they come in and out of the facility, having been transported to court. It's better for DPS not to have to pay. We understand that, and that's why we're pretty dedicated to the project, and the Supreme Court has made it a priority for our IS staff to work on things. And even to the extent that when the system went down at the Anvil Mountain Jail not long ago, the court system, on our money, sent two staffers in the IS department to fix, to identify the problem, to order the parts, to fix it. And so we, the court system, have ordered about 100% of the equipment that's used in the jails. And, you know, we've prepared RSAs and the executive branch shares in the cost of the equipment, but not in any of our staff time. So we will continue to do that, and the court is dedicated to it. Some of the changes I've suggested are a little bit mild and hopefully are maybe well received by the sponsor. So that legislative intent is okay. I don't know that it's absolutely required.
All right. And so, Mr. Chairman, based on that, and I think we all want to work on it, and so it's not just something we want to put on the court system, it's something that we all want to look at. Is there operative language in a court rule change that would be better to work at than the intent, or do they have to work together?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I've been talking to the Department of Law about changing all three of those. Now, the mild change in Section 1 that I suggested would just to be to say that that the court system and the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Corrections continue to work on this area. And I imagine that won't be I imagine that will be received okay. Everybody does want to work on this, from what I understand from the executive branch. The court rule change just modifies the language a little bit to allow a little bit more discretion. The Supreme Court has worked very hard on the video conferencing rule and how it stands now. It was recently reviewed. It was kind of hotly contested by the Criminal Rules Committee. There were different versions presented to the Supreme Court. So what's in the criminal rule now was very carefully crafted. And so the changes brought in this bill were something that we looked at pretty closely and tried to suggest fixes that would still adhere to what the Supreme Court thinks ought to happen with video conferencing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we'll look forward to maybe some language that would come forward, and I'll be interested in taking a look at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Mann.
To the chair, I just want to kind of put on the record that given these sections, we are reexamining our fiscal note and considering that if this is a priority for the legislature and the administration, we may be asking for funding for the positions and the equipment to continue doing this work. So I just wanted to disclose that so it doesn't surprise anybody.
Understood. And that goes with our discussion yesterday in Judiciary.
Yes.
If we need it, now's the time to get it right. Thank you, Mrs. Mead, if you want to clear off the hot seat.
Nope,
sorry. I thought I should have asked one more time. I thought it was clear. Senator Kosaki.
Thank you. And I don't know who can answer this question, but when a person is arraigned by video with a judicial officer, do they have counsel present?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, in Fairbanks, it's my understanding that there may not be defense counsel present. And actually, whether counsel is present and has the ability to consult with privately their client is one of the big sticking points of video conferencing. So there needs to be, approved, a privately accessible phone lines. There can be a private conversation or a room or something at DOC. And in Fairbanks, I'm not certain of the current situation, but I do know that that's identified as an issue and something people want and need to have happen. So I'm not certain if that's been changed.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. I've heard of that in Fairbanks, that issue, and that's why a lot of them are transported. Are we denying a person a right if we're using video conferencing but not having counsel present? Or does counsel, do they drive in, or how do they communicate with, if it's a public defender, for instance, how do they communicate with their defendant?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, I would have to look into that a lot more. But again, this is one of the sticking points with video conferencing. There just needs to be a means for people to talk to their client at, you can imagine, especially at subsequent hearings where issues come up that that the client does need to talk to their counsel about. So I can get back to you on where and when that happens, but that is why in some places there isn't video conferencing, because there isn't an ability for the defense attorney to be with their clients.
Just one last question.
Go ahead.
Did you really run a 2201?
Yes, she did.
Absolutely, wow, Senator.
That's scary. Senator Ebel.
Thank you.
So, you know, I don't want to, you know, go too far down this path, but I am very concerned about the victims. And it just seems like, oh, you want to hurry quickly, get the defendant out. Well, sometimes the victims are so beat up, they don't even know what happened, you know, when they're trying to process, you know, some of the data to even see what kind of a danger these people are to society. Bottom line is here, I think that this discussion is not over. And I think it's just really, really important to, you know, if you're so worried about the defendant getting swift punishment, then maybe we need to work on the pretrial delays and the judges quit allowing, you know, so many things to be delayed over and over and over and over again. So, you know, there's a huge problem, in my opinion, with the courts and allowing so many pretrial delays. So if you want swift, it doesn't need to quickly get this bad person out on the streets again. Why are you worrying there? Why aren't you worrying where the real punishment happens in the courts? But anyway, I didn't really want to go down that path, but I was getting kind of perturbed of how people really are so worried about the defendant. I'm worried about the victim, and I'm worried about the punishment once they know that that person, you know, is an issue and a concern, and why so darn many of them are released out there, and why there's tens of thousands of people being affected by this horrible crime epidemic right now. We need to do something about it.
I don't think you really need to answer that, but I think that was
pontificating.
It's okay.
Very
understood, and it isn't the victims or it should be at the center of this discussion.
Absolutely.
Any other questions before I screw that up again for Mrs. Meade? Or Lisa Rowe? Sarah Coggle?
Well, we worked on the video conference, and I think we need to keep working on it. But there's a couple of sides to it. One of them is how quickly we do it. The other one is that people get counsel. Under video conferencing, somebody can be intimidated or not communicating well. That could be a language barrier, or it could be an out-and-out intimidation. So I think that's why it's important that these things get brought through. And so I don't think the intent language is wrong. I just wanted to make sure that the court could tell us what some of the parameters of that were. And so I appreciate you working on it, and I think we're all going to work on it. And so I think you're right. It's all of us. We're all in it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Meade. Cleared off. If you don't mind staying for a minute here in the seat, and I'm going to do something a little non-standard. I'm going to pull up my chief of staff, Mr. Shanigan, because I want him to speak to something here that I want everybody to chew on. We had this discussion, and it's going to this is going to center around one of the bigger policy changes of SB 33, which is basically taking pretrial services out of the probation section. And there's a lot going on with this. Mr. Shanigan's former trooper, also worked as a parole officer, so he has good knowledge and background, and I thought it would be worthwhile to hear.
And he worked in DOC.
And DOC, yes. He has a very broad background in this. So I think as we're discussing this, that it's very good to hear that perspective from somebody on the street, and we'll keep the department law. We don't have much time left, so I wanted to preserve some time so that you could chew over these things and some of his ideas or background in this as you go to the next meeting. So please put yourself on the record, and as we discussed earlier, if you could give us that rehash of the information.
For the record, I'm Terrence Shanigan, staff for Senator Schauer. As I went through SB 33, I just wanted to speak to a couple things that jumped out. And it looks like we're working with the pretrial services unit. One of the things that I noticed throughout the bill is we continually reference the pretrial services officer. And I've been in contact with a number of corrections officers and asked them a lot about this pretrial services unit. I spoke to officers that have been in the unit. And what was it like before, and what was it like after? So there are some nuances throughout this that I think we just have to understand. And I'll try to walk through a couple of them really quickly. But they were probation officers. There was a blend of two different types of people that were hired in the pretrial services unit. Some were off the street, they had no experience in corrections, and others were seasoned corrections officers that came over and were hired. The corrections officers that were hired that I spoke with were probation officers, many of them. And they continued to be probation officers, but they fulfilled the pretrial services duties. So in here we're talking about, and there's language in here, and it might have existed with 91, dealing with pretrial services officer. They still considered themselves probation officers, and they did clarify that their classification was still a probation officer, not a pretrial services officer. So as I look through here, I highlighted all the areas where we were referring to this pretrial services officer, and they explained that that was a duty that they had. Another nuance that I noticed throughout this was that in 91, we separated out somebody that just did pretrial services duties and then probation officers. When talking to them, they explained that that was a redundant system that required two people to do one person's job, and that it was more effective and more streamlined if the duties of pretrial had been combined with the duties of a probation officer. And the reason being is there were often times when you have a circular system of people that are in and out, they may already be on probation, and now they're in pretrial again because they got arrested or for another charge. And there was some concern as well from those that were probation officers that came over from the institution that that they brought institutional knowledge. They understand the gaming of the system that goes on by some that are in the revolving door. And it was a very healthy thing to have people that were a part of DOC system coming into this, servicing these pretrial components versus having somebody that had no institutional knowledge or working knowledge of some of the people they were working with. One of the things I've also been speaking with people outside of the system as well as inside, asking them, were all parts of the pretrial services unit things that we should be discarding? And the question almost uniformly was no. So there were some great parts of SB 91 that the pretrial services duties were actually trying to address. And I think as we go through some of these, especially SB 33, we should look at those components that may have some good elements to them and not lose the baby with the bathwater in this one. The pretrial services component does allow us to facilitate some prevention activities with people in a specialized situation. And although it might not end up in a zero fiscal note, when we have to cover the costs of, say, ankle monitoring, there are things like what Clinton and Haida have been proposing to DOC for a while, which is allowing them to come into this and support pretrial services from a private perspective. So I think that there are some options there as you look at this and work through it, and I can leave a copy of, you know, we can get a copy. That would just be some concerns that we've sort of raised in here with that distinction between the officer. There was one section in particular, section 15, line 18. It talks about the powers of the commissioner. And it describes setting up a probation system. And as you work throughout it, right below it in section 16, we start going back into this pretrial services officer. So you can see that there's sort of an uncomfortable nuance there where we're asking probation officers who always believe they remain probation officers to do pretrial work. And that would be something to understand as we make all these changes, because we went from an old system to this new one and we're going back. And there's this accordion effect, and I think that we have to make sure that we're cleaning this up so that it's very clear and that we don't lose maybe the good elements of the pretrial component and get it lost in the responsibilities of the commissioner of the department.
I want to open up to questions there for Mr. Shanning with the background. We're about at our time limit, but I thought this would be a very helpful primer in this discussion, and we can, of course, bring him back up. Did you have another?
I had one more point. On section 19, line 14, this was another distinction. It says the duties of probation officers when acting as pretrial services officers. I specifically addressed this with the pretrial, with the officers that were in that unit. It's more accurate to say duties of probation officers when conducting pretrial services responsibilities. So I know that they may have been referred to in language as officers, as pretrial services officers, but they were clear that they were continue to be probation officers.
So as you can see, there's a host of things here, and I'm going to get this into flying terms for myself. So my analogy for this one was you have F-15C pilots, and I'm going to take a lot of grief from this and for the military guys when they see this, and you have F-16 pilots, right? F-15C pilots are air-to-air. They specialize in one mission. They get really good at it. You have an A-10 pilot. He specializes air-to-ground, really good at it, but you have a lot of platforms that specialize in multiple things, and it's very hard for them to be good at all of those missions. This is akin to that, so one of the things we're asking them to do are multiple things where it gets more difficult to cross those streams. That was my analogy for the day. I think, Senator Reinbold, you had a question or time to go? Okay, we're going to go ahead and finish up here for now. Obviously, this, as you can see, we have a long way to go. There's a lot with this one, so we'll be back on Thursday, and we're going to go ahead and knock it off for the night here when I find my script so my staff does not get mad with me. Here, can I get it right? If I can find it. Oh, boy. I did something with it. It's okay. My staff just saved me by bringing up the script for tonight. Okay, so here's what we're going to do, folks. We're going to thank the departments and Mr. Shanigan for coming up for today. We'll be back on Thursday to continue with this bill, and we should have a CS that has technical and conforming changes that time. This concludes our regular business for today's committee. At this time, we're going to recess until 6 p.m., and then we're going to do public testimony tonight for Senate Bill 33, arrest, release, sentencing, probation. So we're going to gavel out this time. We'll see you back at 6 for public testimony. Thank you. I'm back in. Folks, back with State Affairs at 6:13 p.m. on Tuesday night. We're going to open up public testimony for Senate Bill 33, arrest, release, sentencing, and probation. And at this time, it's been a very minimum number so far, as in one. So we're going to go with Katie Botts, who's testifying from Juneau. And Katie, can you hear us?
Yes, is this repealing 91 or Senate Bill 33?
This is for Senate Bill 33, and if you could put yourself on the record, and if that's the bill you intend to testify for, go ahead and give us your testimony.
I'm sorry, sir, but I was looking for Senate Bill 91, so I'm super sorry.
This is a part of Senate Bill 91. There are five bills this session that have been filed by the governor, or four by the governor, one by Senator Michicki, sitting beside me, that work on Senate Bill 91. Are you sure that you did not intend to call in for Senate Bill 33?
Okay. Then perhaps I take that back. I'm super sorry.
That's okay. This one, just so you know, to make sure, this is about arrest, release, sentencing, and probation. And that's the change that this Senate bill is about. Is that the one you're looking for?
I thought there was one that for repealing Senate Bill 91, but since I am on the airport,
Katie, this is Senator Michicki, and I'm sorry, I can't apologize for the administration for sending out a very confusing Facebook note, but All of these bills are related to 91. This, you know, you remember how they're split up. You've had interest in 35, which is in sexual assault. This one is specifically on the arrest and bail issues, kind of pretrial bail issues. So it's very specific to pretrial bail and arrest. Considering the way it was sent out there, I think you can give us your general feelings on the 91 issue, and we will try to make a message out of it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator McGuckey, for that. So if I understand it correctly, there is a lot of areas in confusion in regarding to Senate Bill 91 to where police officers and state troopers are not able to make not able to follow out to their job. So if there are any way possible to be able to reinstate the true mission, go back to the basics, please. Go back to the basics of what our state troopers and what our police officers are supposed to do. They're supposed to protect our people. They're supposed to keep criminals in prison. They're supposed to make sure that our communities are safe. So the longer that these criminals can stay in prison, the longer that they can be away from the society, that's what is going to be needed. And it's really frustrating to hear that even police officers and state troopers don't think that they can do their job adequately. And there's so many people like myself as an adult. I do not look highly to police officers anymore. I do not look highly to state troopers anymore because they do not, they cannot do their job. So please allow them to do their job, allow them to have the control that they need to have, and allow them to put criminals of all kinds in jail for a good length of time. So I guess that's what I would have to say.
Thank you, Katie. And could you just, for the record, clearly state, since Senate Bill 33 does actually repeal sections of SB 91, do you support or oppose Senate Bill 33?
I do support Senate Bill 33.
Thank you very much for taking the time this evening. We actually have one more person that's popped up, Michael Van Linden from Juneau. Go ahead, sir, if you hear us.
Yes, I do hear you.
Go ahead with your name and who you represent and give us testimony, please.
Sure. My name is Mike Van Linden. I represent the Alaska Therapeutic Court Alumni Group. And so I'm opposed to SB 33. And the reason why is because I've seen the therapeutic court was in Juneau specifically was underutilized. And since the pretrial services came online, that's actually helped with funneling people into therapeutic court. And so people are actually getting the help that they need because they're actually using that pretrial service. And then another thing is, you know, we need to not discriminate people based on whether they can afford to bail out, you know. And so in my opinion, I think that the pretrial service is a great service, and we haven't given it a chance to work. So, and, you know, we need to get, you know, give this a little bit more time before we start repealing anything. So, yeah, that's pretty much my point is that I just don't think that, you know, repealing stuff before it's had a chance to work is really a good idea. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Michael, for taking the time to call and testify this evening. We're going to switch to Don Haberger and Juno. If you go ahead, sir, with your name, who you represent, and proceed with testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name for the record is Don Haberger, and I'm community coordinator for the Juneau Reentry Coalition. Our coalition has been functioning prior to our criminal justice reform processes before SB 91. So that kind of gives you the history of our coalition. We've been involved in the issue of making our community safe or helping making our community safe for quite some time. When SB 91 came in, we supported a number of those. In any system that allows those that want to come back to the community and become productive members of the community, i.e. leave that process of criminality behind. And, you know, again, adding to that community is something that the Reentry Coalition supports. I think there were a number of good tools in that, and giving tools like the pretrial assessment to our courts to make informed decision is an excellent tool. And it's something that the coalition supports. Anybody that is low risk, the evidence suggests that when you mix them with a high risk of criminality population, their increase to recidivate also goes up. And we just oppose that. So I would ask that the committee, as they deliberate on these issues, be very mindful of making sure that there are appropriate exit strategies for those that want to come back to their community and be participating members. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking time to call in this evening with your testimony. We're going to switch over to Eric Reed in Wasilla. Go ahead and put your name on the record, please, who you represent, and give us your testimony.
Hi, my name is Eric Reed, E-R-I-K-R-E-E-D. I'm calling in regards to my wife, who can no longer speak for herself. December 13th, 2017, she was killed by a drunk driver, and my son and I, at 4 years old, he survived. I'm not quite sure what he and I survived, to be honest with you, with everything that's going on. The guy that committed the act, the murderer, for lack of a better term, has been out on third party with electronic monitoring. And it's been over a year and a half, about a year and 3 months, and we have no justice. And it would be an absolute tragedy for this guy to be able to apply his time served to his sentence. He gets to spend all his time with his wife and kid and his family, but my son and I, we have nothing. We go to PTSD counseling every week, and my wife's three other kids, that's a phone call every week for me about their mom and lack thereof. So it would be nice for people to understand where the victims lie. Everybody wants to try and rejuvenate these criminals, but nobody wants to make these people accountable for the decisions that they make. It is not fair at all. It's not about rejuvenating criminals. It's about taking care of the people who are victims of this crime, multiple crimes. We're the ones out here struggling. We're the ones that are trying to survive. We're the ones that are upholding the laws. We're the ones out here paying taxes. We're the ones doing everything we possibly can to continue to live life. And I am trying to make heads or tails of my life and my son's life. And it's really hard when everybody wants to consider rejuvenation of a criminal. This guy made a decision. He decided to drive drunk. He decided to take his vehicle, drive home, and you know what? My wife is dead because of it. There is no remorse. There is no reconciliation. There is nothing that will bring her back. And it's between me and my son and God every night that I have to console him back to sleep when he has night terrors and nightmares. So electronic monitoring and credits and all of that, at some point, somebody has got to make these people accountable for the decisions that they make. Nobody's willing to do that. When are we going to stand up and tell these criminals, look, you can't be doing this stuff? If you don't make him an example at some point, then what are you doing? What is it that we're holding on to? If you give him a how-to guide on how to escape law, how to get out of jail, literally, how to get away with murder, literally, then what are we doing? And as elected officials, that is your job, upheld by the people. That's what we're doing. Send a message. For the love of God, send a message. It's common sense. Send a message. If you do something wrong, you don't get out of jail free. You get in trouble. You go to jail. You spend your time. There are people who are without loved ones because of this. Do something about that.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. And I know we've heard from you before. I believe it was last week, and I'll say it again. I am very sorry for your loss, and believe me, we're looking at it. So thank you again, and I imagine we might hear from you, and I hope you continue to call in to help us with the message. Your story is compelling, and I know it matters. So thank you for taking the time to call in, and I believe we have a question from Senator Reinbold.
Eric, I thank you so much for your testimony. I can tell you that I have dealt with some pretty defiant people that have been convicted of DUIs and repetitive over and over crimes, and I feel really bad for you and for what happened. I really want to say thank you. We were talking about being victim-centered. We just had this discussion a few hours ago and addressing the pretrial delays. I just feel terrible that your trial has not been completed, and I just feel like the courts are delaying justice. And I wanted to say, if you could just thank you from the bottom of our hearts for calling in. We are working on it, but just say yes or no. Do you support this bill? I believe you said yes, but I just want to make sure it was on record.
Well, I support anything that would make somebody accountable for the sins that they're guilty of. So however that equates to your bill, I know there's a lot of ins and outs to that. So for me personally, and for my wife who can't be here and voice for herself, I would say no. I'm not in support of anything that will allow somebody to get away with something and not pay for it.
And I assume that means, Mr. Reed, I hate to assume, but you support SB 33, which takes it back to, in many cases, pre-SB 91 sentencing. Is that correct? Or not sentencing, but arrest, release, sentencing, et cetera. Do you concur with that?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you again for taking the time this evening. We're going to switch over now to Samantha Light and the Matsu Leo. And I apologize for taking so long, but you just popped up that you were going to testify now. Samantha, can you hear us?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
I'm very new to this, actually. I kind of came across this in a feed. SB 33 has a lot of very good parts and portions to it, and I absolutely agree with the gentleman prior. The court system does need to be more active in timely case management. But as far as receiving credit while electric monitoring, I believe that is absolutely an okay thing. It needs to be used as a way for people under courts to, be proactive in their counseling and their behavioral management and so forth and so on. My son spent 6 months on EM before he went to jail, and then after that, another 6 months before he was sentenced without receiving his credit on electric monitoring. This time that he has would have just been prolonged and then taken longer out of his life. He's a young man, and he's got a long, long road ahead of him. There's a few portions in SB 33 that I don't agree with, a rebuttable presumption. Yes, some charges like recidivism, a person's record of conviction, those sort of things do need to be taken into consideration when even being allowed to EM out in lieu of court appearances and so forth and so on. It just scares me that my son at 20 years old is looking at not being able to resume his life until he's 35, whereas before he never even had a speeding ticket, a seatbelt ticket, nothing. He had no record of anything at all, and he is just one out of a dozen kids in his situation out of the Fairbanks area. I understand that he would be grandfathered in, And then the gentleman prior to that, he said, we haven't had enough time for this to wash out as a good or a bad thing. And I understand that crime rate is absolutely a horrendous.
Mrs.
And
Light, could you wrap
it up? I do appreciate the efforts that the state is taking in protecting our citizens and so forth and so on. But I don't feel that using a blanket amendment to try to fix a blanket house bill
Samantha,
that beginning with is going
to... We've got a few other people to go through. Could you wrap it up, please, with the support or oppose? Okay. Thank you very much. I hate to cut you off. I just want to make sure we get to the other folks that are waiting. Thank you for taking the time to call and testify this evening. We're going to switch to Karen Nelson in Juneau. How do you hear us? Karen Nelson, can you hear us? If you do, go ahead and put yourself on the record with your name and who you represent. Give us your testimony.
Hi, yeah, this is Karen Nelson, K-A-R-A-N-E-L-S-O-N. Sorry, they just asked me to spell it. You didn't.
You bet. Go ahead.
I'm from Juneau, and I'm representing myself today. And I appreciate this time to testify. So I'm in opposition of SB 33. Some of the reasons are removing the credit for people on electronic monitoring while they're trying to address their mental health and substance use addiction. I don't see any evidence where that's going to be furthering our public safety if we take that away. And it's deterring people from seeking the help. Yeah. Also, got it.
Karen, if you can
hear
us.
Me?
Sorry. You're back. We just lost you, but you're back.
Okay. I'm sorry. There was a lot of static there. I do like the fact of using video conferencing for pretrial hearings and whatnot. I think that's very helpful in a lot of areas. I just think that in this particular bill, SB 33, it's just, again, we're going back to a system that we already know doesn't work. And I hope that, and I appreciate the fact that you've all taken the time and want to take the time to really listen to every single aspect so we don't get into situations that are creating more harm. These particular situations, for instance, you know, people having to post bail and not having the financial stability to do so, spending longer times in prison when they're in pretrial, I mean, these are the kind of things that actually create less public safety, and there's a lot of evidence towards that. So I'm just in opposition to SB 33, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for wrapping it up at 2 minutes, Karen, and taking the time to call in this evening.
Yeah.
We're going to switch over to Robert Dorton now in Fairbanks. If you put yourself on the record and go ahead and testimony, please.
Hello, my name is Robert Dorton. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. Yeah, and I oppose the SB 33 also. I'm not sure if you hear me. Do you hear me?
You're loud and clear, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I oppose it mainly because the reason of eliminating credit for receiving rehabilitative services while on EM. I'm on EM right now, and I have a 3-year EM due to my drug charges, and I have a lot of you know, I'm responsible for what I've done. I've took responsibility. I've been in prison. And I came to the 3-year mark, and I got granted EM. And since I've been granted EM, I've done things to change my life around. I know it's rare, but there are cases like myself that where people do decide that enough's enough, and what am I going to do to make amends with my community? And what that looks like to me is today I'm in RADAC training in Anchorage. And I'm signed up for rural human services through the UAF, and I've done the reentry program, the reentry coalition program in Fairbanks. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to live a better way and assist my community in any way. So I'm about to start a peer support specialist job here shortly. And one of the things I'm doing is I'm learning about addictions, and I've been clean for 6 years now. And thank God to Centerville 91 that I even got this chance of coming out here and being able to you know, make fix some of the ruckus that I've caused. Because when other addicts see me, they're like, if he could get clean, I could get clean. So now I'm an attraction to the recovery world, and that's what I'm trying to do, and that's what I wanted to stress is never give up. Let Centerville 91 go for a little more while and let them see the numbers at least on what's going on with the crime and all that. I know it's high, but let's get the numbers in. Let's give it a chance to get its third cycle. I know it's only had 2 cycles, so if we get another cycle, that would be great.
Mr.
That's
Gordon,
what I got today. So,
thank you very much for
it. Thank you for giving me the chance, and I appreciate you guys.
Thank you for calling in this this evening, Mr. Dorton, and I'm glad to hear that you're getting your life back together. That's awesome. When you get a success story, it's encouraging. Take care and good luck. And we're going to go ahead and looks like at this point we are out, but that kind of came out of the blue, so that 10 minutes turned into 40. So there you go. At this time, I don't see anybody else to testify, but we need to make sure that we have anyone in the room. Anyone? Mr. Ogan, if you want to come put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, that's all you get.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Ogan. I'm senior policy advisor to you, but I'm speaking as a private citizen tonight. I've lived in Alaska for 44 years. I do not like the Alaska that I now live in and because of the crime issues. I've never been a crime victim until about 3 years ago, and I've had my car broken into twice. I've had my mail stolen. My son, just last week when I was in one of these hearings, had his truck stolen in front of his house in a nice neighborhood in Anchorage, and they just took it for a joyride and needed a ride. They stole his truck. They stole his baby seat and his prescription glasses. Fortunately, the APD did an excellent job getting it back. I'm working on this bill. I'll stay away from the particulars, but I do support this effort. I think it's very important. And my heart breaks for the Alaska it's become. I don't like being in downtown Anchorage. I don't like being in downtown Wasilla. It's even dangerous out in my neighborhood. And my new neighborhood is Seldovia, and we fortunately don't have those kind of problems there. And that's one of the reasons I'm there, other than that it's beautiful and it's awesome. It's a happy place. But anyway, I really applaud what you guys are doing, and we need to take a reasonable look at what works. So thanks.
Thank you for taking the time to come in this evening, Scott, and testify for us. I would mention as well that a few weeks ago when I was taking testimony on these crime bills as well, my son-in-law's truck was broken into one of the nights while I was sitting here. So this is a recurring theme. Is there anyone else in the room here that would like to testify? I do not see anyone else online, so this time I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on SB 33. Concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs Committee will be meeting again this Thursday, March 14th, 3:30, back in this room. Be a first hearing on Senate Bill 73, successor of Lieutenant Governor, and we'll be bringing back up SB 33. This bill, arrest, release, sentencing, and probation to consider a proposed CS as a working document and continue our deep dive to try to get it right. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 6:47 p.m.